Well, here we are again. It's Friday, 21st of October, 2011. My name's Cameron Riley. If you've never been here before, this is the No Illusions podcast, where we kind of talk about some of the news that's happened over the last week that you may not have seen covered in the mainstream news. A little bit of politics, a little bit of social awareness, maybe a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of religion. A little bit of conspiracy theory maybe even as well. So I guess we need to talk about the Occupy movement, what it's been up to this week. I haven't followed it that closely around the world, mostly in what's been happening in Australia. Now, last week we had a number of Occupy Melbourne, Occupy Sydney, Occupy Brisbane protests happen. And just this morning, this being Friday, October 21st, in Melbourne, the police came in and removed the protesters that were in City Square, arrested some, apparently. According to The Age, it says riot police stormed the Occupy Melbourne camp, arresting protesters at City Square as chaos spills out across Swanston Street. Angry scuffles have broken out in the middle of the CBD thoroughfare, blocking trams and drawing hundreds of protesters and spectators swarming onto the road. Police on horseback are being caused to try to disperse the crowd. Several people appear to have been arrested while others are staging a sit-down protest. Police arrests... police threat of... let me take a drink of coffee. Police threats of arrest have been met with chants of, "We can't hear you!" Officers in riot gear storm the makeshift tent city at 11:30 a.m., forcibly removing protesters from the square after about 100 defied a 9 a.m. eviction order from Melbourne City Council. Within minutes, police and contractors had torn down tents and moved items from the camp to the end of the compound. So apparently the Melbourne City Council just decided this morning that traders were suffering, according to Lord Mayor Robert Doyle. Traders were suffering and events planned for the square had been disrupted by the week-long demonstration. So they decided they'd just move everybody out and arrest the ones that wouldn't go. The question is whether or not this is legal. I think they're accused of trespassing. Although it says they're in City Square, you would think City Square is actually controlled by the people, although knowing Melbourne, it's, you know, I think it's built on the actual area that they're on is probably private property, might be owned by a property developer. Not exactly sure what's going on down there, but this is one of the things that happens in a country where you don't have a bill of rights. God damn, this coffee kick in. No bill of rights in Australia, so things like freedom to protest or freedom of speech aren't exactly protected. I don't think they're protected in the Constitution. They may be protected only by a legal precedent. We certainly don't have a Bill of Rights. So be interesting to see what happens. The protesters in Melbourne claim that they will be back as soon as they're released from custody, and they'll be protesting, if not in the city square, somewhere else. But, you know, there's this interesting thing happening in Australia where governments are stopping people from protesting or threatening to stop them from striking. We had a big strike on here for the last couple of weeks happening with Qantas, our major airline. A number of their workers, including their engineers and their baggage workers, were on strike. And just last week, the trade minister, who's a former leader of the major union, the biggest union in Australia, the ACLU, he came out and said that the government might force the workers to go back to work because it was affecting tourism. Actually, it was the tourism minister, not the trade minister. Martin Ferguson's the tourism minister. Said that the government would force the people to go back to work. It's interesting, too, in talking with conservative friends over the last couple of weeks about strikes in this country, always amazes me how conservatives think that government should not interfere in business until such time as the workers go on strike, and then conservatives are all for the government getting involved and forcing people to go back to work. Apologies, I just realised that I hadn't put my iPad and iPhone in flight mode, so there was probably some little bit of interference coming through on the line. My bad. Turned off now, it's all good. Speaking of the Occupy movement, there was an interesting article in, I think it's the drama section of the ABC's online website, abc.net.au, during the week from a prominent political blogger here, Greg Jericho, has a blog called Grog's Gamut. Anyway, he was taking issue with the Occupy protests in Australia. Here's some quotes from his blog post. The Occupy Wall Street protesters have had enough of the system. They, like the Tea Party supporters, are not happy with the bailout of the banks. There may be difference of belief and solutions and also ways of going about achieving them, but both groups are children of the global financial crisis. The American Wall Street protesters definitely have legitimate beefs. Much also has been made of the statistic that 1% of American households control 35% of the wealth, which is pretty breathtaking when you pause and think about it. Even more astonishing is that the top 20% have 87.2% of the wealth. Add to this factors such as the top income bracket kicks in a mere 35% for those earning over $379,151, and the fact that 261 of the 532 members of Congress are millionaires, and it's not surprising that there might be a few who think that the political system is rather weighted against the average Joe. But when we turn to the Occupy movement in Australia, as with the attempts to frame the anti-tax groups as Australia's Tea Party, I see only organisations searching for reality. Sure, the vibe is bad, but the reality is starkly different. Here our unemployment level is 5.2% compared to 9.1% in America. Our top income tax rate is 45% and kicks in after $180,000. The top 20% of our households, the ABS conveniently informed us last week, accounts for 61.8% of net wealth and 42% of disposable household income. Yes, the bottom 20% only hold 0.9% of net wealth and 7.4% of disposable income, so we're not some equality wonderland. But given the outlandish desires of the Occupy movement in Australia, a bit of perspective is helpful. Sorry, I just had someone walk into my studio / office / cigar store. So basically he's saying that there's no justification for the Occupy movement in Australia because things aren't as bad here as they are in the US. Here's my issue with that. Whilst I totally agree, you know, the people in the US have got it a lot worse than we do in Australia. The concern that I have about Australia is that we are moving in the direction of the US. Both of the major political parties here in Australia are leaning very heavily to the right these days. As the example I used before, the supposed Labor Party that's in power here, one of their ministers talking about breaking up a strike because it was bad for tourism. And, you know, we've got CEO pay is out of control here. I've got some stats. Let me pull these stats up that I pulled out the other day. You know, one of the things that happened with the Qantas strike is that just before they went on strike, the CEO of Qantas announced he was taking a massive pay rise. I'll get some stats on that as well in a minute. But it says in Australia, let me see the stats here. In 2001, the average annual fixed pay, that is excluding bonuses and other incentives for a CEO, was $808,407. If you included News Corp, which moved to the US in 2005, it would have been over $1 million, $1,008,012. In 2010, it had risen to $1,929,062. So there you go. So from 2001 to 2010, the average CEO pay has more than doubled. You know, a lot more than doubled. A couple of hundred thousand over doubling. Here we go. 117% increase. For comparison purposes, the ASX S&P 200 was 3,206.2 at the end of 2000 and 4,745.2 at the end of last year, an increase of 48% compared with the 117% increase in base pay for executives. Meanwhile, the average worker's pay has gone from $42,500 in 2001 to $65,000 in 2010. So a 52.3% increase in the average worker's pay in that decade versus 130.6% average CEO pay. Oh, it's even more than that. Oh, okay. The numbers and the stats I've got here are different. Anyway. Whoa. Yeah, they said the average CEO pay has gone from $888,000 in 2001 to over $2 million in 2010, 130% increase. So in 2001, the average CEO was earning 20.8 times the average worker. In 2010, it's 31.4 times the average worker. So, you know, we're seeing excessive CEO greed, corporate greed in Australia. We're seeing the move towards more user pay system. We're seeing corporations get more power. One of the examples that Greg Gamet was using in his blog post to counter corporate power is the plain packaging legislation against cigarette companies here and the carbon tax, which is, you know, as we both know, as we all know, those two things are driven primarily by the fact that the Greens won the balance of power in the federal government this year. Whenever we had a last election last year, I guess. And so they're able to push through some of these agenda items. Now, the Greens obviously aren't a corporatist party, but the major party, certainly the Liberals and the Labor Party, are becoming more and more corporatist as every decade goes on. The Greens, as they have been able to get a little bit more power, have been pushing through some reform. But generally speaking, we live in a corporatist society, and I think the Occupy movement can be justified by people wanting to stop the flow of political power in this country continuing to end up in the hands of the wealthy, the elite, and the corporations, as we've seen happen in America. We might be a decade behind America in that move of power, the concentration of power into the hands of the elite. Doesn't mean that we have to wait till it gets that bad before we try and do something about it. And while we're talking about CEOs and stupid, Steve Jobs. Oh, my goodness. So I've seen a couple of reports about this in the last few days. This one is from San Francisco Gate.com, sfgate.com. Steve Jobs refused a surgery that could have saved his life, his biographer said in a 60 Minutes interview. The Apple CEO died earlier this month after a long fight with pancreatic cancer. Some have speculated that Jobs could have lived longer had he sought the treatment of modern medicine. But this is the first time someone close to Jobs had said he avoided treatment. In the interview, biographer Walter Isaacson says that Jobs refused surgery when he first heard he had a tumor. Steve Jobs didn't get treated right away, Isaacson said. He tried to treat it with diet, he goes to a spiritualist, he goes through various ways of doing it macrobiotically, and he doesn't get an operation. Isaacson said Jobs told him he didn't want my body to be opened, I didn't want my body to be violated in that way. I think that he kind of felt that if you ignore something, if you don't want something to exist, you can have magical thinking and it had worked for him in the past, said Isaacson. The full interview would be showing on Sunday on CBS. You know, I'm a big believer in eating well, in exercise, although I don't do enough of either of those things, quite honestly. And in, you know, trying to deal with medical conditions in naturalistic ways. But when you have something like pancreatic cancer, you know, be serious about it. I mean, my dad did a similar thing. He was diagnosed at 53 with lung cancer and decided to start, you know, drinking health shakes and taking supplements and, you know, unsurprisingly died 3 months later. So even though I think in his case the doctor said there wasn't much they could do with him, it was pretty advanced by the time they discovered it. But, you know, this whole idea that you can defeat cancer by taking some supplements or eating a macrobiotic diet, it might stop you from getting cancer in the first place, but once you've got it, I think there's nothing wrong with once you've got it, you know, having a healthy diet might help your chances at recovery, but, you know, have surgery, get it cut out. Ah, oh, Steve. Okay, here's something interesting. David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist, runs the Eagleman Laboratory for Perception and Action, is the author of a book called Incognito, which I've had on my to-read list for a while, but I haven't picked it up yet. Must do that. Neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine, which is where his laboratory is. Interesting interview I saw with him on Boing Boing the other day, where he says, we all go through life assuming that time is an external river that flows past us, but experiments in my laboratory over the past decade have shown that this is not precisely the case. Time is an active construction of the brain. We can set up simple experiments to make you believe that a flashed image lasted longer or shorter than it actually did, or that a burst of light happened before you pressed a button, even though you actually caused it with the button, or that a sound is beeping at a faster or slower rate than it actually is, and so on. Time is a rubbery thing. Now, as you've probably heard me talk about before, if you've listened to this, time doesn't really exist. From a physics perspective, there is just space-time. Time is another dimension of space. And according to Einstein, time is merely an illusion, albeit a persistent one. Time is something that that we perceive to be something that that is flowing or that we are moving through. But really, it just exists everywhere and every when, just as space does. Anything that has ever happened or ever will happen is happening right now somewhere in space-time. So that little quote anyway reminded me that I need to get David Eagleman's book and have a read of it. Again, the book is called Incognito. David Eagleman should be a good read. And I'll give a plug at the moment for another book that I'm currently reading. I think I mentioned it last week, Alex Rosenberg's book, Atheist's Guide to Reality. I'm about halfway through. Just reading a section at the moment on free will. Let me bring up the iPad and the Kindle, and I will read to you some parts of it. La 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 la. Oh, here we go. Chapter 8, the brain does everything without thinking at all. In this chapter and the next two, we will see that several of the most fundamental things that ordinary experience teaches us about ourselves are completely illusory. Some of these illusions are useful for creatures like us, or at least they have been selected for by the environmental filters that our ancestors passed through. But other illusions have just been carried along piggyback on the locally adaptive traits that conferred increased fitness on our ancestors in the Pleistocene. These fellow travellers are the ones we need to stop taking seriously because they prevent us from recognising the right answers to our unavoidable questions. What is more, in the environment we humans are creating that will filter our own future evolution, they may turn out to be maladaptive traits. As nihilists, we can't condemn maladaptive traits as morally bad ones, but we certainly can figure out whether or not these maladaptions are ones that we or our successors would want. La, 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 la. Some of the conclusions to which science commits us sound so bizarre that many people, including scientists and philosophers, have gone to great lengths to avoid them, deny them, or search for a way of taking the sting out of them. Among the seemingly unquestionable truths science makes us deny is the idea that we have any purposes at all, that we ever make plans for today, tomorrow, or next year. Science must even deny the basic notion that we ever really think about the past and the future, or even that our conscious thoughts ever give any meaning to the actions that express them. I don't expect you to accept these outrageous claims without compelling arguments for them. He goes on to talk about how free will doesn't exist, all sorts of things that I talk about on the show on a regular basis. So it's a very good book. I'm enjoying it immensely. What else do we have here to talk about? Oh, yeah, the Bible Geek Show. If you haven't heard the Bible Geek Show, it's a great podcast. I listen to it on a regular basis. It's produced by my good friend, what's his name? Dr. Robert M. Price. Dr. Robert M. Price has been on the show here once or twice before. I've read a number of his books. He's one of the most prominent academics, theologians, biblical historians, I guess, who who propagates the Jesus is a myth concept. I think he was formerly a pastor or an evangelist of some kind. He was a priest, is now an atheist and believes that Jesus is a myth. But very, very funny, very articulate, and very knowledgeable about biblical history. Here's a clip from his October 11th show that I thought might be interesting for you.
Okay, what is a mystery religion? Okay, this is not a mystery in the... Well, I'll tell you why it's a mystery. Mystery, mysterion, just means initiation. The mystic was one who had been initiated in a ritual that was not to be known by the public. And he or she learned some sacred secrets that, again, they were not to divulge. And so it was, that's all it meant, an initiation. And the mystery religions were various Mediterranean faiths that had grown up as agricultural renewal rituals, usually with dying and rising gods who represented the vegetation or perhaps the sun declining and then the longer days again. Which is sort of two versions of the same point. And the idea was that the god had won some great victory to renew nature and conquered the death, symbolizing the death of vegetation. And the rituals were performed, usually starring the king, to facilitate the passage from the winter and the autumn to the spring and summer. These would have been called mystery religions, or at least scholars do. And the mysteries were these rites and rituals. When people from these cultures, these agricultural societies, moved into cosmopolitan civilizations like Greek and Rome and so forth, into urban settings, because they were merchants that resettled there, or soldiers who had come back home there but been converted to some of the mysteries away from home, they brought them back, or somebody had been taken as a prisoner of war and sold into slavery and were brought to an urban environment. Well, you would naturally look up your countrymen there who were also there for whatever reason, and you'd set up a kind of an ethnic religious conclave, birds of a feather, right? And now the agricultural link was severed because you were in an urban setting. And so the ritual of initiation came to have to do not with the rebirth of nature, but with a spiritual rebirth of the individual. And so what happened to the king now happens to all initiates, all mysti or mystics. And so individuals would pay their way into one of these mystery cults and seek salvation through the purification and the ritual initiation. The difference is a religion is the common faith of a country or a society. A cult is a sociologist would say, is a transplanted religion that still sticks out like a sore thumb in a new setting. And I discussed this in my latest Zarathustra Speaks column that just went out, called Is Mitt Romney a Cultist? You got to know what a cultist is first. Okay, now, so mystery religions don't really have anything to do with magic, but what about curses? There are curses in the Bible, and it does work. It's the same thing as a blessing, only you wish woe instead of weal onto someone. The Bible does not tell you, well, at least the Old Testament does not tell you not to curse. If you want to and you feel it's necessary, go right ahead. It's what it prohibits is taking the name of Yahweh, your God, in vain, using it wrongly, which probably meant swearing by it, but lying, committing perjury, in other words, or taking an oath that you would get a certain job done in a certain time, and then you don't do it. So breach of contract. We have Laban and Jacob swearing an oath. May Yahweh watch over me and you as we part. Well, that isn't happy trails to you. Rather, it means don't think you can get away with anything, buddy, because Yahweh is watching. Mitra had that role in the Rig Veda. He was a guarantor of pacts and oaths. So the Bible says don't do that, but it doesn't say not to curse anybody. And some people get cursed. And the idea is you are calling on God to avenge you or to punish the wicked. The imprecatory Psalms are all about that. Oh, may another inherit his property. May his sons be orphans and his wife a widow and so forth. You're calling on God to sick him, and there's no thought that you shouldn't. That raises questions. Suppose you leveled the curse of God on somebody who didn't deserve it. Would God just stupidly go along with it? Presumably not, but if he did, I guess it was your fault. It does work just like a blessing, where it's assumed that something good is going to happen to the person whom you bless.
Well, there you go. I found that interesting. Hope you did too. That's Robert M. Price, The Bible Geek Show, explaining a little bit about what a mystery religion is, what that means, where it comes from. That's the show for today. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out some of the other podcasts on the Podcast Network. Listen to my Napoleon Bonaparte show, napoleon.thepodcastnetwork.com, if you've never heard that. It's a corker, even if I do say so myself. Very, very popular show, 30, 40,000 listeners still every month, even though it's been in retirement for the last couple of years. But it's the entire history of Napoleon, over something like 50 episodes, myself and David Markham. Oh, I just crushed a cashew. let me just clean that up. I'm going out for a cigar. Check out PerdomoCigarsAsia.com or PerdomoCigars.com.au if you're in Australia. Just launched my Asian site. We're selling cigars into Asia. So if you're listening to this anywhere in the Asian region, check us out. Otherwise, what else can I say to give it a plug? I don't know. Oh, you can go on to pygg.com and send me some money. Some listeners have been doing that recently. I think you send it to my Twitter address, which is Cameron Riley, R-E-I-L-L-Y. You can send me a tip. I can use it to buy books and learn new things that I can share with you. All right. And if you're ever in Brisbane, pop in, have a cigar and a drink with me at my cigar lounge, the Perdomo Lounge. Thanks for listening. Keep fighting the good fight. It's Cameron out.